Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
the only podcast that matters,
discusses the only band that matters. Okay, what do we got here, Patrick?
Oh, Jim, it's Red Stripe.
There's a reason for this, right?
Yeah, so I was reading a book about the Clash, imagine that, and it was called The Real Story of the Clash by Pat Gilbert, and in one page he says, band's friend Jock Scott says Red Stripe and Spliff are what the Clash ran on.
Red Stripe and what?
Spliff.
What's Spliff?
You know, might be a little bit of strong marijuana.
Oh, okay. Okay, I rely on you to, you know, to understand that vernacular.
So we have one half of the equation going.
All right, yes, only one. We're having a punky reggae party.
There it is.
Right. Okay, so this is Rockin' the Suburbs. We are in the suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And it's a very exciting, momentous week,
big,
right?
Man. I've been preparing for like months.
I know. It's Clash week.
It really is.
And it's Clash week because it was 40 years ago this month that the Clash's debut album was released in the UK.
That's right.
Not in the USA.
Not in the USA.
That came a little bit later, but this is recognized as the 40th anniversary of that great band.
Right. April 1977.
Yes. And I know that you're a big fan.
I'm a
big fan.
Huge fan.
We both have all these records.
Yeah.
We have quite a collection here.
A lot of vinyl over here.
And where would you rank The Clash in terms of your all-time favorites?
Wow, they got to be right up there. I mean, I don't think you can have an appreciation for punk music or post-punk music or, I don't know. Music, yeah, you know. The only band that mattered, their label once called them. So,
right.
Yeah, I think they've got to be, you know, in the top 10 of anybody's self-respecting, greatest bands of all time. If they're not, you're just not being honest with yourself.
There's something about The Clash that just hits you. A part of it, I think, is the way they played. I mean, when you listen to music, that's the first thing that gets you. And I think they are a great example of one of those bands that just has a unique sound that can't be replicated.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that just happened when these guys got together and played. It was in the chemistry and sort of like the feeling of the way they played. You know, they were always just sort of like a little bit ahead of the beat, and they just fit together so tightly, and it just worked. There was an attitude in the music. There was a certain rawness to the music, but yet they composed different styles too. There wasn't like a Clash template, but you knew it was a Clash song, right?
Yeah, that's right. And they played furiously fast for the time and with incredible wired energy, but yet they still appreciated pop music and hooks and classic rock and Elvis in the 50s and all that stuff, and somehow made it all work together and seem really cool. And what a weird collection of individuals they turned out to be. But you're right, there was a magic between those four that you find, I mean the classic four, that you find very rarely in rock and roll. And I would say importantly too, Jim, that you know, they carried the torch for punk rock at a time when it seemed like the whole movement was just going to be show and flash and, you know, vomit and spit and curse words from the Sex Pistols. And, you know, maybe this was just some sort of, you know, teen insurrection. But the Clash came along and politicized it and showed maturity and showed history. And they did everything that had to be done. You know, they were the opening band at one time for the Sex Pistols. And suddenly they were the torchbearers within a very short period of time, right? And they wore that mantle well. You know, they were always experimental. They were always honest with each other. And they were unabashed in their love of music.
Well, that was the other thing, too. When you say the only band that matters, or mattered, whatever the phrase was exactly.
A marketing phrase.
Only band that matters.
Yeah.
It went beyond just the music, but to what you were saying, the substance of their songs, what they were actually singing about, felt like it actually mattered.
That's right.
You know, the Sex Pistols, there was that rage that just kind of blew everything open. And there was, you got the sense listening to them that it was, you know, it's from a real place that it came from. But still, it was very defeatist, you know, no future for you, all that kind of stuff. You know, the Ramones as sort of the other, you know, the New York side of things, loud and fast and tight and loved, you know, music, but goofy, you know, for the most part. It was about having a good time.
Always comic book style.
That's right. The Clash, like, there's hardly any, like, love songs. There's a few. Mm-hmm. Most of them are political songs. There's obviously Rage, like the Pistols, mm-hmm. but what's different about it is it's more of like a call to action, right? It's not just it doesn't have that attitude of just like, it's not a call for anarchy so much. It's more of a call for, you know, people to pay attention to what's going on in this world and go out and, you know, you have the power to make a difference, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you got the sense, at least for me, I know we probably should hear something here in a second, but at least for me, you know, when I discovered them and really got into them, maybe I didn't understand all the references. Maybe I didn't understand everything they were talking about, but I always got the sense of like, it was important.
Yeah, that's right.
And that they knew what they were talking about. They weren't just, you know, tilting at windmills, right? That they actually understood this stuff. Yeah.
And I think some credit should be given to their manager, Bernie Rhodes, mm-hmm. at the time. And mm-hmm. he'll be a recurring character, I think, as we go through this week, right? He'll pop up in many interesting places. But you're right. Let's hear the first song on their first album. It's a love with rock and roll. So it's Janie Jones.
So you're saying that's the first song on the debut record,
I think,
right?
So.
But not the one I grew up with.
No, me neither, actually.
So we'll get into that in just a moment. But anyway, Janie Jones, what do you have to say about that song?
You know, I'll say this. It didn't sound, you know, right now as fast as it did when I first heard it. When I first heard it, it sounded lightning fast, right?
Yeah, and, for the times. I mean, that was crazy.
Yeah, and shouted in this crazy British accent, and what was he going on about, right? But still in the middle, there was this cool rock and roll, whoa, kind of harmony thing that I really dug. And I think that kind of encapsulates a lot of the music we're going to talk about this week, Jim, because when you think about the Clash, it's hard to separate now from then, right? Context is really important with this band. We know now how influential they were, how experimental they were. But at the time, nobody did. You know, they were just listening to punk music, and it was a sound they grew up with that vibrantly reflected the life they lived in London or, you know, whatever English city it was. And it's important to remember how those two things were different.
Yeah, I think, so a couple things. One is with Janie Jones, mm-hmm. which, by the way, my friend in Rockford, Illinois, Mike White and his band, they covered that.
Oh, great choice.
And what a great tune. But
shout out to Mike White.
Yeah. But I was just looking at we have the two versions of the vinyl here.
So this is the big controversy.
It's not exactly fair because, you know, so one is the UK release, one is the US release. Mm-hmm. UK release came out this month in 1977. The US came out like a year and a half later, or maybe
1979,
actually. More than that. Yeah.
So it came out just before London Calling. They reissued The Clash.
Right. So we'll get into that in a mm-hmm. moment. And Janie Jones is on both versions, but yet Janie Jones opens up side two on this one. It's a really bizarre how they resequenced it. It's almost like
totally crazy.
They just threw the names of the songs up in the air and then put them back together in a totally different order. But anyway, what I was going to say is I noticed in your vinyl copy of the mm-hmm. US version, there's no lyrics printed. Now, was that the case when it came out? Do you know?
I don't know for sure. That's a copy I probably bought in 1982 or so. I think that's when I bought it, or three, something like that. So it may be a reissue, or maybe they just didn't bother and didn't put the lyrics in.
I'm going to guess that they didn't at that time.
They may not have.
And because I recall, I had that on cassette mm-hmm. back then, also in the 80s. And I just remember like listening to Joe Strummer that you couldn't quite figure out what he was saying, but you really wanted to. You wanted to listen to it over and over again so you could try to figure it out. And it wouldn't work so well if you had the lyric sheet. Now, this reissue I have of the UK release has a lyric sheet in it, but it may not have at the time because it's a reissue.
Yeah.
It might be the thing that they do now. Anyway.
Well,
but that was true for a lot of their songs. Like, you really wanted to figure this out. Like, what is he talking about, right? Because as a kid, you know, in my case, you know, a kid in the Midwest, it all seemed so completely foreign to me.
And, you know, the chief difference between the two records being the fact that the Clash were growing so fast and absorbing so many influences that even between the time they put out their debut and they put out their second album, right, they had recorded these songs and these singles here and there, right, that were just too good not to put out. So they became British singles. They appeared on EPs.
Yeah.
And so that's what the American folks at Epic Records had to deal with when they were putting out the reissue of the first Clash album, right? They were like, oh, there's all this old stuff, you know. But in America, it was kind of a common tactic. Like when the Beatles records came out, they switched them around, right? Or, you know, they would remix Elvis things and they would do all kinds of different. It's a historical thing.
It is a historical thing. Yeah. Although I think it had kind of subsided to a large extent by about the late 60s or so. So it was kind of a return to that do this.
In many ways, yeah.
The reason why CBS, Epic Records, didn't want to put out the debut in the U.S. originally is because they just thought it was like too loud and too, you know, furious for American tastes. And in not putting it out, it ended up becoming... Did you say the biggest selling import in the U.S.?
Something like 100,000 copies sold on import at a time, as you and I discussing, when it wasn't easy to get an import.
No.
Like, you couldn't walk into, you know, Tower or Kent Mill Records or Musicland and find an import section. No. Very rarely.
It was usually some mom and pop shop,
you know,
run
by
a weird
record store. An old hippie had a shop in town. Yeah.
That's right. And that's where you would get the imports.
That's right.
Get the good stuff.
Get all the good stuff. You might be able to get something else in the back room if you signed a paper.
That's right. So the song I wanted to play is on both of the versions.
Mm-hmm.
It is either track 2 on the version I grew up with or track 3 on the version the Brits grew up with.
Big difference.
But it was something that immediately would attract somebody, again, you know, living in the Midwest.
All right.
Okay, so a couple things about I'm So Bored with the USA.
Yes.
One is, I think the opening of that song sounds a little bit like Steve Jones, the Sex Pistols, right? So already you see sort of like, they're part of this culture, they're getting some influence, which is also funny because, although we're not going to play it today, the song White Riot, which was their first single, is very much sounds like the Ramones.
Mm-hmm.
So, so they definitely, you know, were listening to what others were doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of figuring this out early on.
Mm-hmm.
Although, as you and I both know, they went far beyond both of those bands in terms of musicality.
Totally.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Yeah. Now, the other thing too is, you know, you just look at this song, I'm So Bored with the USA, and you know, it's this obviously is a very British record. It's very much speaks to what's going on in Britain. And at this point, I'm pretty sure the guys had not even left.
No.
Britain, the UK at that time.
Right.
So what are they talking about? I'm so bored with the USA.
Yeah.
And you want to know as an American. And, you know, what And also, you know, as a kid, you're sort of feeling like, hey, they're speaking to me. I'm so bored with the USA, yeah, right?
Totally.
You know? But what it really is about is sort of like the influence of American culture on Britain and,
yeah,
and the fact that they're trying to push back against that, right? Mm-hmm. Reject that.
Yeah. And I think musically, it's really interesting to me because it's one of those Mick Jones music songs, right? Mm-hmm. Which has got some cool hooks and, like you said, maybe absorbing the influence of everything that's happening around him. And then Joe Strummer comes in and says, I got something that'll fit that. Mm-hmm. And right. And he lays those political, you know, double entendre, double meaning words on top. And suddenly you got this great song.
So let's do this now. We got a call,
yep,
on our Suburban Party Line.
Love the Suburban Party Line. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, we asked people on the social medias to talk about their favorite Clash album.
Yes.
And we got somebody who said the debut is their favorite.
Hey guys, it's Joe Fleischer. I'm calling about my favorite Clash album, which is definitely the first one. Because at the end of the 70s, not a lot of new music was getting through to my suburb in Raleigh, North Carolina. I went to see Supertramp, I think, that year, and Cheap Trick, and, you know, the bands that everybody listened to. Somehow, I think based on reviews, I got my hands on the first Clash album, and it was just like this howling anger the instruments. I just loved it from the beginning and played it endlessly and still love it today. Thanks. Bye.
So thanks, Joe, for that
call. Thanks for the call.
And again, you know, he says the instruments, and what's funny about that is the debut is mostly guitar-based drums, right? Mm-hmm. There's a few other little flourishes in there from time to time, but that's pretty much it.
The Clash put this record out on CBS, which is a major label, right? And they signed a contract, I think it was like January of 1977, and literally a day later or 2 days later, they were in the studio recording White Riot, right? But also for a major label. And, you know, there was a famous quote from, I think, Mark Perry from the Sniff and Glue fanzine, where he said, punk died the day the Clash signed to CBS, right? And so they had a lot of, you know, pushback from the hardcore punk community, the hardcore fans of the music, that they had sold out and signed with this major label. Yet Mick Jones embraced it, right? Said, yeah, we want to be big stars. We want to influence everybody. You know, he was a fan of Mott the Hoople, and right,
that's right,
he loved a lot of music.
Like he that. Liked a lot of the classic rock. He loved the Beatles and the Stones and the Who, and you mentioned Mott the Hoople, which,
yes,
you know, was probably his, mm-hmm, favorite band, right? Yep.
And also this album was not recorded with Topper Hedden. So it was not the classic Clash drummer. It was Terry Chimes, yep, right? Who recorded the record. He left soon after they recorded it. And eventually they tried out this huge number of drummers. But so this is a different lineup, you know, than you consider like the classic Clash. And when you look at the front, there's only three people on the front.
That's right.
You only see Paul Simon in. You only see Mick Jones and Joe Strummer. You don't see any kind of a drummer there, right?
It is. I would suggest this is one of the great album covers of all time.
Classic.
And what this for any other band, this might be the greatest album cover art there is.
Oh,
except they have one that's even better.
That's right. They actually topped it. Yeah,
that's right.
But you're right. You know,
one other thing I'll say that's different on the UK and US versions is just where they place the band name.
Yeah, that's right. And sort of that Dayglow orange that doesn't appear on the US version. So, they toned it down to a little red.
It's funny. You worked in a record store. Tell, mm-hmm, me if this is a record store thing or not. In the UK version, the Clash name is at the bottom,
mm-hmm,
bottom right corner.
Yep.
On the US version, it's in the top right corner, mm-hmm, which I would think is better for browsing.
That's exactly right.
The bins, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah. In the US anyway.
Yeah.
It was cooler to, so you could flip through from the top and just sort of see the name, yep, of the band. That was why it was important to get it up there. Yep. Yeah. But you're right.
Which again speaks to the commercialism of the USA, which Joe Strummer's so bored with.
Exactly right. He was totally bored with it. But you're right. As a high schooler or junior high schooler, you didn't even need to buy this record. If you saw it in the bin, there was a lot of information about punk rock that was communicated to you, right? The torn edges, the black and white, the, you know, the day glow colors. Like, you knew at least a little bit if you had some perception, like what was going on here.
And
like
the band,
these guys were at least trying to look tough, and they looked kind of tough.
Well, in the way they were dressed, they already had the look.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and well, so you mentioned Mick Jones being sort of, you know, classic rock influence, uh-huh, Joe Strummer more like pub rock,
yep,
kind of thing, and very much into things like rockabilly.
Yeah, he was in a band called the 101ers, right, that had a single called Keys to My Heart. You know, they were a pretty well-respected pub rock band when Bernie Rhodes and Mick Jones decided, hey, this might be our guy.
Right. And then Paul Simonon, the bassist, yep. was really into like R&B and like Motown and stuff like that.
Yeah, and being super good looking and being into punk rock and learning how to play the bass. You know, he didn't play it so great when he joined the band, but he looked good and he kind of fit in with their style and they got along with him really, really well. So they decided we'll teach him how to play the bass. And, you know, Mick and Joe, I think, eventually taught him to be really, really great.
And then what you're going to hear is, you know, as the week goes on, we're going to talk about each of the five, you know, core Clash albums as the week goes on. They all then got sort of the influence of the West Indies.
Yeah.
Scene, which was because there was a large immigrant population there in London that brought in reggae and ska and dub and all of those kinds of things as well. Not huge on this first record. It comes in a lot more
as the career goes on. Sure.
But there are already some elements of it. And I think you have a song that illustrates that, right?
Yeah, let's try this. There was a time in my life, Jim, when I listened to that song every day for about 6 months.
It's a great song to listen to.
Yeah.
If there's going to be a song you listen to every day, you can't go wrong with that. Yeah. White Man and Hammersmith Pally.
Mm-hmm.
And just before you get into your personal story, let me just say that was on the U.S. version of the debut album. It was actually recorded a little bit later, actually after the U.K. version came out, but included on the U.S. version. So that's where I'm saying you're starting to get this new direction from the band.
Yeah.
Already prominent throughout their career.
Yeah. That song was recorded in June 1978. So really only about 6 months before their second record was released, you know, almost a full year after the first album came out. So that was a single, right? So they had grown that much in that short period of time. But, you know, how do you do something like this where you get a wide variety of things in one song? You get your love of Jamaican music, reggae and dub and ska, right? Because there's a kind of an obvious connection between Police and Thieves and this rhythm, right? The Junior Mervyn song. You also get in the experience of being a white man in London who likes Jamaican music and tries to go to all these reggae shows and dance halls, right? So you get that alienation. And you also get just a great political lyric. I mean, at one point, I think Strummer says that if Adolf Hitler showed up today, they'd send a limousine down to pick him up, right? You know, so there was a lot of heavy stuff going on in the lyric.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a great tune.
Yeah, it really is great.
It's a great tune.
Yeah, really amazing. But you're right. It was on the U.S. version. That's what I grew up with. I had a pre-recorded cassette in my car. I would listen to it every day. And that was, you know, the highlight of this record for me. It was like one of my top favorite songs. Years later, I came to know it wasn't even on the first record.
That's right.
Yeah.
And if you were lucky enough to live in the UK at the time and you bought the single, do you know what the B-side was?
I think the B-side was The Prisoner,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. That's such a great song,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it really is.
Like, oh, yeah. That's, to just tell you the depth of how great the Clash were, that a song like The Prisoner is the B-side on a non-album single.
Right? How great is like, that?
Oh my God, it's so great. So anyway, okay, we're going long, but that's all right because we can talk about the Clash.
We're introducing the Clash.
That's right.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is over the next 4 days, mm-hmm. we're going to talk about the next four proper Clash albums.
That's right.
Studio
and,
albums.
And I think we've kind of set the tone here. We've given a lot of context in the background of the band. So yeah, we'll focus, kind of tighten down on those four records and maybe at the end draw a few conclusions.
Okay, so you should listen, obviously, this week, of any week, you should listen to Rock in the Suburbs.
Every day.
Every damn
Don't miss
day.
A day this week, man.
That's right. You can listen to it on iTunes, Audio Boom, and many others, Stitcher, and TuneIn. That's
yeah.
the other one.
And now you can listen to it, Jim, on... no longer iTunes. You've heard about this, right? Oh. Apple Podcasts.
Oh, it's Apple Podcasts.
It's been rebranded. Yeah. Oh, okay. We've rebranded in the past week or so. We're now Apple Podcasts.
All right. We also want to hear what you have to say about The Clash. We had some people chime in, as it were,
yep.
before we recorded, but there's always time and we can always come back on a fan mail Friday and we can, you know, read some of your comments or
right.
even better, play your calls.
Yeah, even better.
So what you really should do is call our suburban party line. That is 612-440-1984. Tell us about The Clash or anything else related to music. You can also find us on social media. That mm-hmm. would be Twitter and Facebook at Suburbs Pod, or you can email us rock@suburbspod.com and also visit our suburbspod.com website.
Yes.
Where maybe we'll put up some more stuff about The Clash, because I'm sure there's going to be things that I've forgotten to say, and I'll want to say more.
Right.
Okay. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And as we leave you, let me see. I'm going to pick one more song off this
record. Pull the record up. You're going U.S. there, which is fine.
I am, and I think this is another song that is just musically great, but also, again, kind of speaks to maybe some of the desperation of growing up in, you know, working class London at the time. It is called Career Opportunities, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
They offered me the office, offered me the job. They said I'd better take anything they got. Do you want to make tea at the BBC? Do you want to be? Do you really want to be a job? Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. Every job they offer used to keep you up the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. I hate the army and I hate the RAF. I don't wanna go fighting in the Germany. I hate the 7 Sabbath room. I won't open that phone for you. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. Every job they offer used to kick you out the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked.
Oi, 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 oi,
oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, oi, o